rules come to order. It is Wednesday, June 26, 2013. Information: we will not be working on House Bill 3528 today. We will not be working on Senate Bill 215 today. We're carrying both of those over. We'll start with opening a work session on SJR 34. And Senator Brzozinski.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 34 proposes an amendment to Oregon Constitution to permit serving judge to be employed by Oregon National Guard for purpose of performing military service or by State Board of Higher Education for purpose of teaching without violating Section 1, Article 3, or Section 10, Article 2 of the Oregon Constitution. Refers proposed constitutional amendment to people for approval or rejection at next regular general election. There is a fiscal statement on the measure as amended, and there's no revenue impact.
Senator Brzozinski, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. My name is Floyd Brzozinski, State Senator for District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Thank you very much for taking up SJR 34 today. The purpose of this bill, as the committee administrator said, is to allow the voters to determine whether or not a sitting judge within the state can either serve as a teacher within a public university or serve in military services such as in the JAG. The issue that we have before us is separation of powers. And I can tell you specifically, we've had this bill before us before, just have not been able to make it through past the finish line. And what this will allow is for, if passed by and approved by the voters, it will in fact allow for our judges, such as circuit court judges, to actually be able to participate in teaching seminars or classes such as like at the University of Oregon, specifically in their law school. As most of you know, there are three law schools in the state. Two of them are private. Judges can currently serve in those in the capacity as a teacher at those two private schools here at, across the street at Willamette University or up in the Portland area at Lewis and Clark. But technically, they cannot serve as a teacher at the University of Oregon's law school and receive any type of compensation. So what you have are many members of the bar who are willing, that are sitting on the bench, to actually volunteer their time at the law school to teach civil procedure, criminal procedure, and other type of court matters. And so this will allow for them to actually be compensated for that. And at the same time, we also notice that under the potential separation of powers issues of having an individual who's serving again as a judge, who may be working as a reservist in the Oregon National Guard, is also at risk because of being caught up in serving in basically the military branch at the same time as being in the judicial branch. So executive, both of those would be executive branch versus the judicial branch. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of the bill. I'm more than willing to answer any questions for you. I will tell you that in the OLIS packet, you should have testimony that came in from Judge Rasmussen during the Rules Committee on the Senate side, dated June 19th. He also attached to his testimony Margie Paris, who was the dean of the law school at the University of Oregon, her testimony that she had submitted back in 2010 as support for this.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Representative Jensen.
Thank you. A couple questions, if I might, Mr. Chair. First one, I assume this includes appellate court judges, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, it would.
And the second question, I'm puzzled by the serving in the National Guard. Are you telling me they can't do that now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I believe there's a question there as to whether or not they can technically do it, because serving in the military branch is an executive branch position, and they are sitting in the judicial branch, and so that could, in fact, if challenged, could actually nullify their ability to do that. And we felt that this was an opportunity to allow for clarity and allow the voters to say, yes, this is appropriate.
So I would, if I'm
follow up,
that's not currently a statutory sort of thing. It's
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, no, it's not. It's the Constitution that we're dealing with. And what I can tell you is that if you look back, there's in the testimony that was presented writtenly, the Sawyer case, which was back in the late 50s, if I'm not mistaken, the voters were, in fact, requested and did, in fact, approve to allow for teachers who are in the executive branch to serve in the legislative branch. And yeah. So this is a question that's just being formulated, has precedent to take it to the voters and allow them to decide.
And, Mr. Chairman,
follow up
comments on the latter last question. comes from a circuit court judge in my area that, in fact, had the lovely distinction of being able to spend 18 months in Afghanistan or something like that. While assigned to, National Guard call-up sort of thing inside them. But that's potentially challengeable under the existing, is what I'm hearing you say.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hicks, thank you. Thank you.
Good down to you.
Hello, Senator Pazansky. So National Guard and military reserves are two different, not necessarily different looking, but different types of service. Military reserves are entirely federally oriented and based. National Guard does have a state component, a state charter, if you will, through the Constitution. And so is it unnecessary, therefore, because we don't list military reserve service here, is that, would it be unnecessary to list that for that reason or for some other reason?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, it's our opinion that it is, as you said, distinguishable between federal, which we would not be able to, quote-unquote, control, as compared to the state component, and that's why we wanted to clarify, and that's why it's limited to the Oregon National Guard.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Pazansky, so prior to action that we took in 2011, the Oregon University System was a state agency, and its employees were, you know, therefore members of the executive branch. But with Senate Bill 242, we turned OUS into a public university system. Not a state agency. Does that have any effect on this? I mean, would these individuals still be considered executive branch employees in some way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nimbrough, I would have to defer that to Legislative Council. I can tell you the concern that we have had is to ensure that these individuals who have sworn to uphold the Constitution, both the state and the federal, that serve on the bench, are not putting themselves in an awkward position. And so I'm be very frank with you. I'm not sure what difference it makes, but I guess what I would say is this. If, for some reason, we find ourselves back to the traditional mold or model we have, this would make sure ensure that they would not be caught up in that. And if that doesn't, quote unquote, apply to them under the new model, it would be no harm, no foul.
Representative Berger?
Very good point. Thank you, Senator. This is somewhat of an unfair question, but you're the only testifier here, and you opened your remarks with the fact that, that you're hoping to finally get this across the finish line. This doesn't seem like a stretch to me. What was the problem that it couldn't get over the finish line previously?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I should say I object to speculation, but I will try to answer it the best I can. I think there's a thing that starts with a P called politics. I think sometimes there's another word, P, there's personality. I believe that those two intermixed, and we ended up having someone put their foot on the air hose.
Thank you, Senator. I didn't want to put you in this spot. That's I just wondered if there was some organized group that had some.
It was not.
Wasn't any me, further questions for our colleague? Thanks, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, thank you very much.
I'm going to close the, we're in work session, actually, so ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 34 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves SJR 34 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion carries. And Representative Hoyle, would you like to carry it?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Close the work session on SJR 34. Yeah, we'll go back to the top. Open a work session on Senate Bill 145.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 145 was originally heard on June 13th. The measure removes requirement that candidate, political committee, or petition committee provide notice to Secretary of State if discontinuing statement of organization and closing accounts. Revises the requirement that certain electronically filed data may be available on Internet to public free of charge. Removes liability of candidate's treasurer for default or violation that occurs in performance of certain duties. Requires Secretary of State to send notice of civil penalty for failure to file campaign finance statement only to the candidate. Removes requirement for periodic examination and investigation of randomly selected campaign finance statements. Removes requirement to file statement of expenditure deficit. Requires political committee or petition committee that expects neither aggregate contributions nor aggregate expenditures to exceed $3,500 to file certification to the state to the effect of the Secretary of State. Removes requirement that candidate file statement or affidavit if contributions to out-of-state political committees upon request. And removes requirement that certain corporations file report regarding shareholders. At the public hearing, a question came up regarding the removal of the requirement for certain corporations to file report regarding shareholders. We did request an LC opinion. LC is in the room to discuss their opinion here today. We do also, though, have a -A3 amendment that restores that requirement that certain corporations file report regarding shareholders. And there is a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Who's here from council?
Maureen. She's coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Garrett and members of the committee. My name is Maureen McGee. I'm a staff attorney in the Legislative Council's office. Following the previous hearing on this bill, I was asked to research whether the repeal of ORS 260.049 could create a loophole in the campaign finance reporting requirements. And based on my interpretation of the statutes and the legislative history of ORS 260.049, I believe that the answer to that question is yes. To explain why, a little bit of a history lesson is necessary. The legislative history of 260.049 indicates that it was passed in 1991 in response to a particular circumstance where a lawyer found that there was a way to avoid the reporting requirements for political committees. What this individual did was set up a corporation and then allowed people who wanted to support certain political causes without identifying themselves to buy shares in the corporation. The corporation then used the money that was raised from selling those shares, which was the only income that the corporation had, to make political contributions. And the campaign finance laws that apply to corporations generally required the corporation to report that it had made contributions, but not to report who its shareholders were, even though the sole reason for the corporation's existence was for the shareholders to funnel their political contributions through it. The shareholders were also not required to report as a political committee because of the particular ways that the terms political committee, contribution, and expenditure were and are still defined under Oregon law. And just to explain that, political committee, in its most basic definition, is defined as a group of people that receive contributions and make expenditures. While the corporation at issue here was not receiving contributions, because by definition, a contribution is the furnishing of something for nothing in return, and here the shareholders were receiving shares in the corporation in return for their money. The corporation was also not making expenditures, which are defined as the furnishing of something of value for something of value in return. For example, the paying of money to an advertising firm to produce a TV spot in support of a political campaign. Instead, the corporation simply sold shares and then made contributions with the money raised from selling those shares. So in short, the corporate structure that I've just explained gave people a mechanism to circumvent the political committee reporting requirements and to therefore make anonymous political contributions. And ORS 260.049 was enacted in 1991 to fill that specific loophole in the reporting requirements. The statute now requires that if someone incorporates and makes contributions in the manner that I just explained, the corporation would have to report to the Secretary of State who their shareholders are. And since 1991, it does not appear to me that the relevant definitions of political committee, contribution, or expenditure, or any other reporting requirements that apply to corporations have changed substantively in a manner that would otherwise prevent another group of persons from, again, taking advantage of this corporation loophole if ORS 260.049 were to be repealed, and it's therefore my conclusion that repealing the statute would likely resurrect the loophole. And I am happy to answer any other questions the committee has about this particular aspect of Senate Bill 145.
Questions? So can you speak to the amendment in front of us then?
So the amendment, which I believe is the -A3 amendment, simply removes the repealer of ORS 260.049 from the bill. It does nothing more.
So all the concerns that you just told us about would be obviated by the A3 amendment?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Any questions? Representative Kenemer.
Is the amendment not up on our system?
Should be.
Should be.
It's in the dash two.
I don't see it either.
It may just be a simple click.
Right? I got a dash two, not a dash three.
When did that come out?
It's been out there. It's probably just a setting on OLIS that I will change right now.
Oh, there it is. I got it. It opened.
Do you change it for Republicans first?
That's some.
Some Republicans.
Proposed amendment.
Dash two?
Dash two? No, I don't have three.
Okay.
That's three.
I don't have three. I have eight. Two.
Be like I'm east of the mountains all of a sudden.
That's about it.
Well, would members prefer to hold on to this until they can review the amendment?
All right. That's a good idea.
Why don't we carry over?
It's coming right now. You should be able to refresh and see it now.
Yeah.
It's three lines.
It's three lines. Maybe we could come to resolution on this right now.
I don't want to put the
just read it to us.
Yep.
It's the dash threes?
A3.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's stuck there.
The dash three is three lines, and it says on page one it deletes 260.049. On page seven, line 37, it restores 260.049, and before 260.085. And on page 14, line 26, it deletes 260.049. And we have copies of it coming right now.
So literally, all it does is remove the deletion of that statute. Mm-hmm. And restore references to it.
Yeah.
Which achieves.
With that in mind, are there, why don't we take a motion and see if we have any
concerns? Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 145A.
Representative Hoyle moves the dash A3 amendment to Senate Bill 145. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 145A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 145A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries, and I will carry the bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 145. Open a work session on Senate Bill 158.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 158 was originally heard on the 24th of June. The measure increases maximum civil penalty for violation of election law or rule from $250 to $1,000, eliminates requirement that certain ballots be printed in different colors, increases time allowed for mailing of ballots from 18 to 20 days before date of election. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendments on the bill.
Yeah, we heard this bill just 2 days ago. And it's ready. We have paperwork. It's ready to move.
Chair Garrett, I move Senate Bill 158 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 150A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Representative Kenemer.
This moves the penalty up to $1,000, doesn't it?
The maximum penalty on the matrix, correct.
Yeah, don't support that.
Okay. Further discussion before we call the roll? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Dembro.
Yes.
Representative Foldy.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
No.
Representative Kenemer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
Nope.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. Bill's moved to the floor, and I'm happy to carry that
okay.
one, too. Close the work session on Senate Bill 150.
Let's jump to 414.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 414.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 414A was originally heard on June 24th. The measure allows Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to seek restitution and other equitable relief on behalf of consumer for actual damages consumer suffers as a result of insurer's violation of insurance code, breach of contract or policy, or violation of applicable federal law. Clarifies action by director is regulatory and does not create cause of action for any other person. Declares emergency effective upon passage. There is no revenue, no fiscal impact, and no amendments before you today.
All right. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 414A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, Hoyle moves Senate Bill 414A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Representative Holvey, do you want to carry the bill?
He's thrilled. Sure, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to.
It's a unanimous committee vote. Okay. Close the work session on Senate Bill 414. Where should we go?
Let's go down to...
What's the under-over on the no votes?
Senate Bill 600. Open a work session on Senate Bill 600.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 600 directs District Boundary Board to accept petition from city for change in school district boundaries if specified conditions are met. There is an emergency clause on the original measure. You should have a -4 amendment. It replaces the measure and requires Beaverton and Hillsborough school districts to enter into mediation within 30 days of the effective date of this act to resolve disputes about school district boundaries between districts. If resolution is not reached, school districts must request change in boundary of school district by requesting or petitioning for proposed change or merger in school districts to district boundary board of county or counties having jurisdiction over the affected school districts. Does not preclude filing of remonstrance petition for election on proposed change or merger. Remonstrance is to be signed by at least 5% or at least 500, whichever is less of the electors of the school district affected by the proposed change or merger, to be filed with the district boundary board within 20 days after that date that boundary change is to become effective and when all district boundary boards have acted on change or merger. Participating school district must submit report related to mediation to Interim Committee on Education no later than December 1, 2013. There's an emergency clause on the amendment. This measure has a minimal revenue impact and a fiscal impact was issued.
Anybody here to speak to it?
Not that I see. I don't see the...
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 600.
Can
I have a question?
Yes.
Before the motion, she said a lot of words in a one-page amendment, so I'm assuming that the process that she described is in ORS 330.095?
Correct.
I just want that on
yes,
the record.
Yes, that is correct.
Because I'm reading this, and it doesn't say all that, but...
Good point, right.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Garrett, Representative Berger, that is correct. I detailed out the ORS that is affected in the amendment.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I just wanted that on the record.
Okay, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't normally carefully read the emergency clause, but in this case, I think it's reasonable to note that the purpose of it is to preserve the public peace, health, and safety. This may be one of those situations where that's seriously involved.
There are rumors that support that view.
Yes, there are. So Vice Chair Hoyle has made a motion to adopt the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 600. Is there discussion on the motion? Okay, is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries. The bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 600 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Mr. Hoyle moves Senate Bill 600 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Hicks.
Thank you. For counsel on the amendment lines 13 and 14, nothing in this section precludes the filing of a remonstrance petition under statute. What is a remonstrance petition?
Remonstrance petition is when it allows a affected district to require a vote of the people affected by the boundary change. So if they provide at least 5% or 500 signatures of the electors affected by the school district change, it would go out to a vote of the people affected.
So that this entire mediation can be sort of short-circuited by that process, right?
If they are, as I read the amendment, if there is no resolution, then yes.
Well,
presumably that's what acting in good faith implies.
Yes. Is that?
And yeah, so, but okay, I'm trying to carefully parse, but I'm reading, so section 2 and 13 and 14, nothing in this section, meaning section 2, precludes the filing of a petition under the applicable statute. So, if one of the districts, I don't know if this is going to happen, but I mean, if one of the districts wanted to say, well, that looks very nice, we're just going to go ahead and skip to the remonstrance petition, the mediation process gets skipped. Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I am probably not the best person to answer that question. I do not.
Well, let's run it out.
Yes.
And then I'm not going to vote for it until I get an answer to that.
Pardon? Ozzie Rose can answer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Ozzie's here. Would you like to come forward? Mr. Rose.
Actually, Grandpa's the preferred seven, but for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I work with the Hillsborough School District on this issue. And the mediation takes place. If it is successful, obviously, it's over. If the mediation is not successful, the districts are required to ask for an order from the boundary board.
Okay.
The order of the boundary board is what is subject to remonstrance by the citizens, not by the school district, by the citizens of either district. And that's the process, by the way, that currently exists. And so this mediation is being added. If it isn't successful, go to the existing process.
I'm following that conceptually. Mm-hmm. What I'm getting hung up on is just the way the amendment's written. Okay, I mean,
yeah.
Do you happen to have a copy?
14.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at the way the thing's written, and it just says nothing in this section precludes the filing of a remonstrance petition. Effectively, my first take on that means that the entire mediation process can be skipped. The statute is saying there's this mediation process, but I don't see anything that's frankly mandatory about it.
But if I could, Mr. Chair, what I understood Mr. Rose to say was that the remonstrance is by petition of the voters in the district. That presumably would take some time to file a petition and then gather signatures on it.
And
that doesn't sound like it's something that's going to come up early in the process. It would come up late in the process, wouldn't it?
Yeah. May I?
Please.
Ozzie Rose again. I'm saying the remonstrance at that point would be a remonstrance filed a proponent of the change, and they would be allowed to get signatures. The districts wouldn't be able to file that remonstrance. There's two places to enter a remonstrance. One in the current system. One is an individual who wants the change made. They can go get signatures and take it to the boundary board, and they order the change. And then those who don't want the change, they have a right. They have a limited days, 21 days or something, to get the signatures. And I believe what that section four is in it for is to protect the right of the individual to go ahead to heck with the mediation. I'm going to get it done. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I think LC is here.
Representative Holby and then Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume the with the Dash 4 amendment, it virtually replaces the bill, and it starts out by directing the Beaverton School District and Hillsboro School District to enter mediation. And so I was assuming that's what this entire bill was about, but I guess I have a question. When you go on to sub 2, sub 3, they speak of school districts in general. So I'm wondering, does this apply to any school district in the state if this is put into statute, or is this statutory change strictly directed at the Beaverton and Hillsboro school districts?
This statutory change is confined to the one situation, not even other districts in Washington County, for example.
Yes, follow up.
Follow up on that, then. I'm curious why the current process of establishing boundary districts in our state isn't adequate to solve this problem.
I'm not a proponent of changing it, so I'm not a very good one to answer that.
We have somebody from LC on the way, by the way, to speak to this amendment.
Is that you, Dan? He's here.
He's here.
No, we're waiting for Hannah.
For Hannah.
Oh, okay.
Representative Jensen, in the meantime, question?
I thought LC was here.
That's for a different bill. We're waiting for a different LC for a different bill.
We're having the legal fee same day. Problem I think that everybody else is having, and I, you know, lack the necessary legal background maybe to raise these sort of questions, but it certainly looks to me like we have something of a problem here with the wording, and I think we could get people remonstrating, you know, individuals, even if there has or hasn't been a resolution, because nothing in this section.
Yes, I see the potential issue with the wording that Representative Hicks pointed out. We just need to see if there's an answer to that or if we need to make a further change.
Excuse me,
Representative Dembrough.
I see. Do you know how long has this happened before? Yes, that there's been a remonstrance petition
in this particular case,
or just in any case?
I assume that has. Yes.
Do we know how long that process takes? You know, I'm just wondering how this butts up against
the process for the proponent. They have an unlimited time to get their signatures and then present them to the boundary board. Once the boundary board makes a decision, anybody who disagrees with that decision, they have 21 days to get the signatures to refer it to the people.
Anna, thanks for joining us. We have a couple questions about drafts. Representative Hicks, do you want to start?
Thank you. As to the 4 amendment, Dash 4 amendment, and we were focusing on lines 13 and 14, nothing in this section 2, that is, precludes the filing of a remonstrance petition under ORS 330-101. What does that mean?
Committee. My name is Hannah Lai, Legislative Counsel. Chair Guerra, Representative Hicks. And to some extent, that doesn't add a whole lot. It's just to clarify that nothing that we're doing in this section changes the status of the law, that you can still go forward and still do the rest of the process that's already established. This is at more at the beginning of the process to kind of get you going, and then once this mediation has occurred, then the rest of the process that's already on the books can kick in and take place. And what's going on in this Dash 4 amendments doesn't affect that at all.
So the mediation is mandatory between the two districts?
Chair Guerra, Representative Hicks, mediation never is mandatory. Mediation is a voluntary act between the two parties. This is saying that they must start it, but after that, mediation is voluntary. They, at any point, can pull out of it. This is not arbitration. It's not binding.
Is So we're directing them to begin a voluntary process, which they could abandon at any point, as long as they act in good faith. And this, what subsection 4 is saying is that nothing in this amendment precludes the filing of our monstrous petition by, who can file that now?
Chair Garrett, I would have to look at the statute again. I believe it's electors can bring it forward. There's certain numbers that must be met. It's fairly specific in the statute, but that's not going to be altered by this.
So the voters can reserve all the rights they currently have.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Not to pretend I'm a lawyer, but lines 10, 11, and 12, I think, speak to one issue. If the resolution is not reached through the mediation, then the districts must request of the boundary school that the boundary board, and that then what would trigger the either the vote or go on and it's changed. Mm-hmm. So there's no way for the districts failing to mediate a solution stops the process.
Representative Jensen, did you have a question?
I just can't read it that way. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Follow up. And so, could we from the top? So, what change substantively is being made by the dash 4 amendment?
Okay. Chair Garrett, Representative Hicks, what? To some extent, the school districts don't have the power to change the boundaries. So that's still with the counties. The counties are the boundary changing board. So the power remains with them. To some extent, no matter what the school districts do, the counties still have to act. So what this is saying is, hey, school districts, come together. You at least have to come together and begin the process, act in good faith. After that, it's all voluntary, but you at least have to come to the table this one time, and we will talk. Try and figure out what you want. Then you can proceed how the statutes are already established. So at that point, after you kind of know what you want, you can go to the county and you can ask for any changes that you want. The county still has to make that decision. It still has to change the boundaries. The school district doesn't have that power. So this is more of just trying to get everybody to talk, being on the same page before they go to the counties and have more official act occur. So, this is kind of like a pre-step before what happens to what you can do on the what's already in statute.
Representative Holby?
Thank you. I'm curious. What precludes the county from settling this to start with? If they're in control of the boundary lines in the districts, doesn't this solution already in statute lie with the counties?
Yeah, Chair Garrett, Representative Holy. Exactly. The counties can go ahead and act without the school districts. This is just an opportunity to give the school districts the chance to try and resolve it and to try and come to reach a conclusion that may be more agreeable to them when they approach the county.
So does this do anything other than require them to sit down to begin a mediation process?
Chair Garrett, I don't think so.
Representative Barnhart.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just parsed through this thing, and it looks to me as though the thing does four things, really. It requires the districts to enter into mediation. I guess that's the word start you were using. Mm-hmm. Then it says that they have to participate, the participants must act in good faith. Well, okay, I guess we can require that. Then it says, if they don't reach an agreement by December 1st, then they have to request a change in the boundary of the Boundary Commission, which is the Board of Commissioners, right? So that's three things. The fourth thing they have to do is file a report with interim legislative committees. So this bill actually does do several things. Whether they'll be effective to settle the dispute or not, I don't know. And I'd have one additional comment. Mm-hmm. I think the bill parses just fine, in my view. I have one additional comment, and that is, if I were on the Board of County Commissioners, the last thing in the world I would want to do is intervene between a bunch of parents and the school boards. I'd want them to have to figure this thing out before they came to me with a request for a boundary change. And I think what this does say is you're going to get off the dime, you're going to get this settled. If you don't get it settled, somebody's going to file for a boundary change no later than December 1st. And all the other processes that are available are still available. And the legislature's going to shake their collective finger at you. If you file a report with them on December 1st, it says it isn't done. That's what I think the bill says.
So do you like it?
I don't know anything about the dispute. I know nothing whatever about the dispute. As a sort of a granny approach to a dispute, you two go settle your differences and then come back to tell me how you did it. It's not bad.
Representative Debro.
My attorney just spoke for me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
And I realize I'm carping on this point, but going to the underlying bill, page 1, line 30, and then line 1 of page 2, it says the board may not allow a remonstrance petition or election. That was the underlying bill, said the board may not allow a remonstrance petition or election. Does that change?
The Senate Bill 600 sets a new, different process than currently exists.
I see.
And instead of going to the boundary board with petition, et cetera, a city board, city council may direct the boundary board to make the change. And there's no involvement in either district in that sense. The city council can decide, fine, if it finds that there are efficiencies and that there are efficiencies in transportation, neither of which have any kind of a measure, and it's pretty impossible to predict 10 years from now what this particular change actually caused in efficiencies. The particular piece of ground they're talking about, there's going to be about 1,000 kids there at some time. And for a city council now to make direction and give direction to the process, that's what why we entered this as an alternative to the bill that's before you. With all due respect, you could go with no bills, and there is a process that involves going through the petition process, and get a decision. And the party electors in both districts would have a say before that was over with.
Representative Cattimer, did you have a question?
Well, just a comment. I thought Representative Barnhart was on track with what this bill does. And for those of us who have been had some limited access to the scuttlebutt, this is quite a difficult disagreement out there. And I think this is an effort at responsible mediation. I don't know if people would agree with that, but that would be sort of my view and get some folks off the hook.
Can we have a few moments of recess?
Sure, recess.
Most certainly.
Sure.
Maybe we'll recess for a couple of minutes.
Okay.
for your patience. We are in work session on Senate Bill 600.
We did have a motion on the table.
And I believe the Vice Chair Hoyle had made a motion to move 600 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Would people like to discuss the motion?
Just so I'm clear.
Mr. Barnhart.
We've already adopted the dash 4.
We adopted the dash 4 amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Discussion. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Dembrough.
Yes.
Representative Holdy.
Yes.
Representative Jensen.
No.
Representative Penimer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hicks.
No.
Chair Garrett.
Everybody?
Yes, motion carries. This bill moves to the floor. Representative Reed will be burdened with this bill. Jerry, close the work session on Senate Bill 600.
154.
Open a work session on what?
Senate Bill 154.
Senate Bill 154.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 154A was originally heard on June 13th. The measure requires organization or entity paying signature gatherers to register with Secretary of State, requires one or more persons representing an organization or entity engaged in signature gathering to complete training established by statute and implemented by the Secretary of State, requires statement certifying that persons trained have read and understood Oregon law pertaining to signature gathering, requires written affirmation that organization or entity complies with law, makes provisions operative January 1, 2014. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We have a no revenue, no fiscal impact, no amendment before you, and I believe Legislative Council is here for questions of the members.
Mr. Gilbert, please. There was some discussion in the hearing about whether this bill would subject people to a unreasonable risk of liability, and we've had some discussions with the representative with counsel, and I asked him to come and brief us on LC's analysis of that issue. So could you speak to that, please?
Absolutely. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert, and I'm an attorney at Legislative Council. So I was, again, asked to come to speak just about the requirement in Senate Bill 154 that a representative of an entity or organization submits a statement signed acknowledging that the individual has read and understands Oregon law applicable to the gathering of signatures on state initiatives, referendum, and recall petitions and prospective petitions for state measures to be initiated as law is summarized in the training and the training program established by the Secretary, and affirming that the organization or entity operates in compliance with the law. And my understanding is that a question has arose with respect to whether a person who signs this statement could face a felony charge for false swearing if the information in the statement turns out to be incorrect. Our opinion is that this would only happen in very limited circumstances. ORS 260.715 and 260.993 hold that a person may be guilty of a felony if the person knowingly makes a false statement when a statement is required under election laws. And the term knowingly is key here and is commonly used in criminal law. Chapter 161, for example, defines the term as meaning that a person must act with an awareness that a particular circumstance exists in order to meet the definition of the standard. And it is our analysis that this means that to convict a person of a felony under this bill, it's not sufficient to show that the information contained in the person's statement was incorrect and that the organization or entity was not operating in compliance with election laws. Rather, you would actually have to show that the person who signs the statement was aware of this fact at the time that they made this the time that the statement was signed in order for it to be a false statement under ORS 260.715. But if those circumstances are met, then there would be a felony.
And when you say show the person was aware of the fact, you mean consciously aware that the organization's conduct was in violation of law?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I think that's useful history to have on the record. Are there any questions for counsel? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Meek, do you want to speak to the the issue?
Dan Meek, Mr. Chair and members, first of all, there are a hierarchy of statutes that apply to making false statements to government. Not all of them have the knowingly language in them, and they have a variety of penalties that include Class B felonies. Some of them are felonies, some of them are misdemeanors. So you can't just focus on ORS 260.715 to determine the penalty for a false swearing under the statute, because that's not the only statute that penalizes false swearing to a government entity. Number two, I think that the Legislative Council's analysis is simply wrong. That is not the way criminal law works. A person can be held responsible for a violation of the law, a criminal law, without knowing what the law is. And what knowingly means is you knew what you were doing. It doesn't mean that you knew what you were doing was a violation of law. And the same thing is true here. And the Mr. Gilbert said that this could result in felony charges against folks. And let's keep in mind what the underlying violation is. The underlying violation is any violation of law or rule pertaining to collecting signatures. Some of those violations are amazingly trivial. For example, let's say I'm a circulator and I've collected a signature sheet. And on the signature sheet, I then sign it and date my own signature. And it's June 1st, but in my mind it's still May. So I start writing the number 5, cross it out and put a 6. Well, I violated an election rule. And under this statute, that makes the person or persons who are responsible for the signature gathering operation, and that includes the campaign itself, not just some company out there gathering signatures, but includes the campaign itself, anyone who pays anyone for collecting signatures, that subjects them to potential felony liability, Class C felony under ORS 260715, and other penalties for false swearing that are less severe than that. But Mr. Gilbert says, well, this would only happen in limited circumstances. True, it would happen in limited circumstances, and that's what makes it, to me, just extremely shocking. In addition, Mr. Gilbert says you would have to show that the person was aware of this fact. Of this fact. Of what fact? The fact of the way that the campaign operates. Awareness of law is not a fact.
Well, that's exactly the question I asked him.
Right.
And
he
said the answer
is
that you're
aware of this fact.
No, I said by fact, do you mean that the organization is operating in compliance with the law? The answer was they have to have specific knowledge of the illegality.
And I don't know Mr. Gilbert's experience in criminal law, but that is just reflects a basic misunderstanding of criminal law.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Gilbert, anything further? Yeah, we have a question for you from Representative Hicks.
And thank you for coming back. On page 3, line 30?
Yes.
So what effect, if any, does that have? What effect does that have on this process?
The affirming that the organization or entity operates in compliance with the law?
Yeah. What does that do? Why is it in there?
Chair Garrett, Representative Hicks, I believe it's in there saying that not only in Part A, lines 26 to 29, that you've read what the law is, but also that you as the representative believe that your organization is operating in compliance with what you have read.
Are you asking what's the point? From the proponent's point of view, the policy purpose is to force the organization to make someone familiar with the operations of the organization and the requirements of the law, and to verify to that person's knowledge that the organization is compliant. And I understand Mr. Meek's testimony. I just think we've made it clear on the record, if there were any doubt, that we do not intend for this to apply to a situation where a person certifies what the organization is doing, and then 5 years later we find out that a court interprets one of those actions to be illegal. That person would not be liable for a knowing false statement. Correct,
Dan? That is correct, Chair Garrett.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 154 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 154 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? You call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Dembrough.
Yes.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
No.
Representative Penimer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
No.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry the bill.
SG 1.
Open a work, close the work session on SB 154. Open a work session on SJR 1.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 1 proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution to finance purpose of Oregon Student Opportunity Fund. Allows use of monies for lawful purpose if emergency is declared by governor and use is approved by 4/5 of Legislative Assembly members present in each house, and if Legislative Assembly has approved plan to replenish fund on appropriate terms. Allows use of all or portion of monies in fund to pay principal of, interest on, and premium on indebtedness incurred under measure provisions if emergency is declared by governor and use is approved by 4/5 of Legislative Assembly members present in each house. Establishes next general election as date for referral on the ballot. The measure has a no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement with the measure. And I believe the Savaggio is from the Treasurer's office here.
Mr. Savaggio.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Michael Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. SJR 1 refers to the voters a measure that does primarily two things. The first thing it does is to create a locked fund called the Student Opportunity Fund that will serve essentially as an endowment with the interest earnings going towards student assistance for post-secondary four-year universities, two-year community colleges, and technical vocational training. The administration of that assistance would be determined by statute. We did not propose to establish any kind of administration guidelines in a constitutional measure, since we may want to hook into an existing agency such as the Student Access Commission that is a statutory creation. The other thing that the measure does is to allow but not require the state to issue bond proceeds into the fund for that purpose. The fund is very flexible in terms of its receipts authority, so we can finance this in many different ways, which I'm sure will be of discussion in the next few sessions if this doesn't in fact pass the ballot. But the one method that we would need to make a specific carve out in the Constitution for is bonding, so we have provided for that option. The Treasurer's Office urges support of SJR 1 so that we can begin setting this up and then have a discussion as to methods of financing and methods of disbursement.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Salvaggio? Representative Hicks.
Can you clarify, what I gather is that this would be potentially competing with other bonding priorities against the overall debt limit that the state is permitted to go into. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, members of the committee, that is accurate. The bonding authority described in the bill, which again for the record is not required but an option for the legislature, would be general obligation bonds that would essentially, if issued, come out of the same capacity as other general obligation bonds such as 11Q, 11P, 11 really A through P without C for some reason. In our mind, we feel that financing the corpus of a student opportunity fund is a worthy cause with very laudable goals in terms of workforce development, et cetera. But again, this is something that is going to have to come before the legislature, something that's going to have to be weighed against other priorities. We do feel that it is a goal that is worthy of being weighed among those other various priorities.
All right, thank you. And so in terms of the debt service on this, can you describe the potential ways in which that would be covered?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, there are a couple of different ways that one could service the debt on that. Initially, the debt could be serviced by the general fund directly, as it's a general obligation bond. However, you'll recall that the committee staff's description of the measure allowed for a supermajority of the legislature to allow for the corpus itself, or by extension the corpus's earnings, to go towards servicing that debt. It is our understanding that at least in the first few years of establishing this, generally this doesn't depend on the actual amount, just because of math, the earnings will be insufficient to actually service the entire debt, because there's a gap in terms of your interest costs. But after about 12 to 15 years, the earnings will, given certain earnings assumptions, be sufficient to cover its own debt. Now, whether or not that actually happens is a decision left up to the legislature, because you guys may decide that you actually want to spin that off into student aid. So again, lots of options, a lot of them, most of them, open to you in future sessions.
So it sounds like, crunching the math on this, a possible, maybe potentially likely scenario is that we're paying the debt service on this out of the general fund for the next 12 to 15 years.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you could structure a bond just like that. You could also structure 30-year bonds. You could structure a 5- or 10-year bond if you liked. And nothing is requiring that it's paid out of general fund proceeds, but nothing's precluding that.
But, it sounds like the estimated earnings from this foreseen investment would preclude, would actually require that, probably. Would probably require us to be funding this out of the general fund for the next 12 to 15 years.
It would be possible to take directly out of the corpus, but then that makes the question, why do that at all?
Yeah, no. Thank you.
Representative Berger and then Barnhart.
Mr. Savaggio, normally this kind of joint resolution going to the voters would have a pretty strong enabling statutory piece that is companion that actually puts sideboards on exactly how this program would work. That is not the case true in this particular one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a companion bill that has, I suppose, been a little left behind in terms of the progress this session, Senate Bill 11. That does contain enabling legislation regarding the administration of the fund, regarding the payment of the bonds, potential bonds, and various sideboards around the disbursement. Now, it is true that that may not pass this session. I want to stress that SJR 1 is on the ballot in November 2014 if it passes the legislature, which means that we will be able to, and the treasurer has committed to, work with the legislature regarding those particular issues in the 2014 and 2015 sessions. The vision currently is simply to, without reinventing the wheel, so to speak, hook that new revenue stream into the Oregon Student Access Commission or successor entity. And in terms of various incentives, sideboards, et cetera, the stated goal has been to ask that entity to work on incentives for things like STEM degrees, on-time graduation, and technical vocational training. So I would say that these are issues that we're very, very keen on developing over the next couple of years and are looking very eager to develop with the, in tandem with the legislature.
Thank you.
Follow up. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as in terms of general fund appropriations into this fund or issuing bonds, are there any other sources of monies that would go into this fund?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the as I said, the fund has very broad receipts authority. Bond proceeds is one direct appropriation by the legislature is another. In addition, the legislature could make commitments in future biennia to deposits. Those could be contingent on a number of various factors. It could accept donations. It could accept gifts. It could accept a federal grant. It could accept private grants. It could also accept some kind of dedicated revenue stream that we can't even think about right now. The takeaway, I think, is that this provides a very, very full menu of options for the legislature to choose from.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you. You're really talking about an arbitrage, in effect. Would these bonds be taxable under the Internal Revenue Code?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, we do anticipate that that any bonds issued for this purpose would be taxable.
Okay, and I think part of, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Part of the point of this, this thing goes to the ballot in 14, in November, so it's a year and a half away. I'm assuming that you're expecting that you'll be able to sell bonds at relatively low interest rates a year and a half from now. Of course, that's much more problematic than if you were doing it tomorrow. I mean, I'm just assuming that that's what you're thinking about, that the rate of return on other kinds of investments would be higher than the bond rate that you would be borrowing the money at.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. I can describe our assumptions very briefly. We have assumed in the very short term taxable interest rates around 4.5% and longer term at 5.5%. I'm not going to try and guess what's going to happen to interest rates over the next few years, but I don't imagine that we're going to see something in the next couple of years higher than 5.5%. Knock on wood, nobody please hold me to that ever. The assumption on returns, we have built in an assumption of 7% average per year. For comparison, the pension fund over the last 10 years has averaged about 8.5%.
Representative Dembro?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, colleagues, that we have, speaking for the House Committee on Higher Education, we have explored the issue that Mr. Sabaji is talking about. We heard from the Treasurer. There is a lot of interest in this on behalf of, students in the state. We're struggling to come up with creative ways of, helping to fund higher education. Now, clearly, whatever ends up being approved by the legislature, in terms of an actual program that would utilize the authority given by the voters, is going to have to pencil out. I think we all agree with that. But I know, speaking for myself, I hear often when I talk to voters, well, why is it we can pay for buildings, but we can't pay to make college affordable for young people? And I think what's being proposed here is a possible route in that direction. And I really look forward to the conversation. If this does pass out of legislature and we have a public debate on this issue, if it goes to the voters, I look forward to that debate.
Representative Hicks?
Thank you. I mean, you've hit on a lot of excellent points, Representative Dembro. I mean, one thing I do want to keep cognizant of, and that we will, is that, frankly, this is going to wind up competing within, with the buildings and with the traditional capital construction. Right. And so that was very interesting to me to learn that this is basically going to wind up being a competition, a discussion that needs to be had, indeed. So, but as long as people are clear on that, I think that's how it's going to play out.
Representative Barnhart?
Mr. Chair, I'd really like to see the bill that Representative Berger referred to that apparently hasn't moved. The problem with passing a resolution like this now is that I don't think there's any provision for pulling it back. And once you've sent it out, I think it goes to the ballot.
It does.
And it worries me that we don't have the sideboards in place. I don't want to sound parochial, but it also worries me that it hasn't been to either the Ways and Means Committee or to the Revenue Committee for vetting on the fiscal issues. It's been through Education Workforce Development, and then it came here. Now maybe in fact it did on the Senate side. I'm looking. I don't see it. I'm concerned about passing a bill like this now without the sideboards having been adopted, or at least in the pipeline along with it. And I'm wondering, and this is probably a question, what's the problem with putting all those pieces together and putting it out in February?
I'm going to take that as a question, if that's all right, Mr.
Chair. Yeah, that's what it is intended to be.
The idea is to, without, in the absence of Senate Bill 11, I wouldn't say that we have no administrative construct around this. This would simply flow through the existing student assistance paths, which is the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. Now, what we hope to do with this is obviously build it and expand it, and therefore at some point we do believe that we are going to need to establish some more robust system of sideboards, checks, balances, allowances, restrictions, etc. In the case of this goes out without sideboards, which I believe that we'll be working on for the 2014 session, there is already a similar program, albeit with a unpredictable and, depending on your point of view, anemic source of funds coming out of it. What this would do is add predictability, stability, and additional revenue to that existing program. In terms of putting all the pieces together first, I think that we've got a relatively good starting point in SB 11. Again, that was to recommend certain incentives and sideboards, and I think that even if that does pass out this session, that still anticipates a year and a half of work to do around that, because what we're talking about is recommendations coming out of that. So whether we pass that this session or just continue to work on that in the interim in tandem with legislators, with the Student Access Commission, Education Investment Board, I think that there's work to do either way on that.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If this measure moves forward and is ultimately given the voter sort of approval, is this just another Band-Aid that we're slapping on the higher education? I mean, or is this going to provide something of a significant and permanent and stable source of funding for higher education?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the permanent and the stability are more guaranteeable. The significance, I think, is determined based on what that financing model looks like. What Senate Joint Resolution 1 is the construct for a permanent and growing fund, that we can count on into the future and that, more importantly, students can count on. This changes what is currently an on-off switch in terms of, I beg your pardon, are you looking to jump in?
No.
It turns what is currently an on-off switch in terms of student assistance into something that we can invest in and will be there in the long term as it also kicks out revenue. So it's the difference, I think, between leasing our student assistance program year to year and actually building equity into it.
Well, follow-up.
Follow-up question.
If this legislature does as the legislatures in the last 20 years have done, continues to underfund education, it's been on a constant, higher education, it's been on a constant downhill slide now for that long a period of time. What impact, how is that going to improve that situation for us?
Sure. The as you well know, the rising cost of tuition fees to Oregon students are in large part a result of the underfunding of higher ed. I think that the data will show. The beg your pardon. The effects that this can have on that is providing a stable and dependable buffer against that that students can count on year to year. They can count on a particular amount. They can count that a particular source of revenue will continue to be available and accessible to them.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Thank you for the indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
No problem. If I may, we are in work session, aren't we?
We are.
You know, my concern, and it has been a concern for some time, but my concern is the just absolutely criminal, I submit, actions that we have taken in terms of funding higher education in the state of Oregon. And I ask you to look at the you know, the funding levels as a percent of the whole pie that Oregon has. And if you have the ambition, desire to do it, convert it to you know, adjusted for inflation sort of thing, and observe where higher education has come out in this amount of funding that we have been willing to commit in this state to our universities and to our community colleges. And you find it has been downhill. As I've commented in the community college budget, and I think the Ways and Means when we were talking about it, the you know, back a number of years ago, we had a 440 or fight sort of goal for community colleges a decade ago. And this time, you know, 10 years later, we're coming in with a request, not even considering inflation in this, and the fact that 440 is no longer the $440 million that it was a decade ago, you know, has been down. We simply, you know, the only way we've been able to keep up with this is to raise it on the other end for students. And, you know, students, as you all are aware, paying a higher and higher percent of the cost. And I you know, hesitate to think what that cost is going to be 20 years later when some of our young legislators start sending their children off to the universities.
Bringing that up.
You know, it's going to be... it's going to be an incredible load if we keep on this same path, and one that people can't afford and one the nation can't afford. So the reason for my line of questioning was a little bit for an opportunity to get to say in this committee that how disappointed I am and how much a failure I feel like as a legislator in not being able to have some impact on higher education funding when it's been clear that the need was there for it. So excuse me for my digressing.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, if I could elaborate a little bit, very briefly. The Student Access Commission, I believe, is given $100 million approximately each biennium, at least this biennium, in terms of opportunity grants. If we were to roll that $100 million into this program, it would increase current opportunity grant levels by 10%. And that's a permanent 10% that the next year is still there, regardless of whether there's an additional appropriation or not. That's what I mean when I talk about building equity in student assistance. So building that up to $6 billion within the next 30 years, again, not a requirement. What that means, assuming population growth and inflation and higher education inflation, is that we can cover the needs gap for every Oregon student that wants to do 2 years post-secondary.
Further questions? Representative Dembro?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to, I appreciate Representative Jensen's line of questions or his comments, and I agree with them totally. And I think that he points exactly to the problem that we face here and why this might be an appropriate solution. Because, you know, it feels to me that colleges and universities, and even more, the student need-based aid grant program is always the last thing funded. And it seems that biennium after biennium, we're told that there's no money. And we don't have, for better or for worse, the discipline to push higher education higher up the priority line. With this, you know, with this mechanism that's being proposed through the bonding, we would be forced to invest in higher education because we'd have to do the debt service that is required. And this would be a commitment that we would be making that, yes, we intend to invest in higher education for the next 10, 12, 20 years. The question will be, and that's one that we'll have to face and that the voters will have to face, is are we prepared to make that commitment? And I would argue that given the tremendous importance that having post-secondary education, vocational education, all sorts of higher education, how important it is to this state, that I would really like to be out there helping to push that argument, because I think its time has come.
I've been asked to hold this bill over for a day, so we're going to close the work session on SJR 1. Mr. Salvaggio, thank you for your time and testimony. And we'll open work session on SCR 20.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 20 is a memorial to Dr. Dean Brooks, 1916 to 2013. Dr. Dean Brooks was a former superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital and played a role not only in the movie but in bringing attention through One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Okay, your work session.
Mr. Chair, I move that SCR 20 to the floor with be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves SCR 20 to the floor with be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Berger?
It appears that, again, I happen to know a lot more than what she just said about Dr. Dean Brooks. He was a climbing companion of my father. I used to camp with his family years ago. His entire family has been dedicated to mental health in this state and in my community for literally generations. He has been an activist and a committed person who has served our state in terms of mental health issues in just gargantuan ways. It is fitting. He lived a long time. He was an advocate until literally days before his death. I would commend this to you as Dr. Brooks being one of the giants in Oregon in his field. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me get that on the record.
Oh, I think we've identified our carrier on the floor. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Moves to the floor, and Representative Berger, would you be so kind?
I would.
So carry it. So, are we doing 3528 or not?
I haven't gotten word, so.
we are carrying over the remaining items, our committee is adjourned.